That's me! I'm glad that you're here. This has been a crazy week. It's been a crazy month. It's been a crazy year, and I'm crazy, so let's get into it. I'm not supposed to say that anymore. My therapist says it's bad. I'm not supposed to character. Okay, so let me just self-correct right now. I'm not crazy. I am unique. I am unique, and you know what? I'm here to tell you, you're not crazy either. It's just that your previous experiences inform your future behavior. So just live with it and always become a better person. That's what I'm doing, and now I'm better than everyone. I've got to stop saying that to people. It's a joke, obviously. I make jokes. This is an awesome podcast this week. I'm going to give you a real big rant about making stuff, about art, about speaking, about really doing it, making it happen, building, build it and they will come. And then you have a baseball stadium where a bunch of semen is all over the place. Build it and they will come. Oh, I slipped on his jizz. Up top, let's do it. All right, so I'm going to talk a bunch about art. I'm also going to do the motherfucking question, of course, which is going to get a little bit deep, a little bit intense, and a little bit in there. I don't know what to say about it. It's out there. You'll hear it. And, you know, thank you to this week's sponsor, Buddy Box. Buddy Box has been an awesome supporter of me, and I want you guys to have the same kind of experience I have, which is lonely, but, you know, good. So give it up for Buddy Box. All right, you guys, let's do it. I'm Lainey, so get into it. Let's do this now. Yes, victory, success, it's happening. Yay! I have a recommendation for you. This is my favorite song that we just listened to as amp up music, and it is Zero by Jean Grey. And she is a rapper, and she is very good at it, even though I know nothing about rap. And Hannibal Buress is on the album, and so is, what's his name? Nick Offerman, and they are doing some voiceover thingies, whatever you call that in rap. I don't remember. There's a name for it. But anyway, the sketchy thing. Well, okay. Let's not embarrass myself here. So that's what I'm obsessed with. You know, I mentioned how Oprah has her favorite things, and these are my favorite things. It's that, and then cold brew, and then that's it. I just kind of sit, and I've been knitting a lot. That's all I've been doing. So, all right, I'm adjusting my. Hello, my microphone.
Are you Captain Morgan?
Hello. Yeah, I am. Okay. Well, I'm getting a job. It's dumb. I don't want it. Okay. We're in the rant now. We're in the rant. This is an essential part of the podcast. We're in it. And I want to say that you are very important to me. You, your haircut, and your children. Not so much your children, but definitely your cats. If you have a cat, send me the cat. I don't want a picture. I just want you to send me the cat. Ship it. Priority mail. That's what I would like. I would really like to interact with a cat. Oh, boy. But you, let me tell you what you, this is our developing relationship, right? It's my relationship with you, the listener, whose name is Kelly. And Kelly, I want you to know if, and also Kelly is a gender neutral name. So let's just get into it right now. You're all Kellys to me, okay? You're all my little Kelly, baby. So Kelly, we've been together for a little bit now. I think that I've explained a little bit about what I need. And by that, I mean, I've said a lot of discordant things that you could piece together that are contradictory. So you really don't have an understanding of what I need, because perhaps I'm not expressing it succinctly because I don't know what I need. But that is what we call life, my friend, Kelly. Oh, boy. So let's check in. Where are we in our relationship, Kelly? You know, we just had the holidays. We just had Thanksgiving. And if you're in the future, pretend like we didn't, whatever. But it's a weird time of the year because this is the time when people start taking stock of their lives. They start thinking about what they're going to do for their resolutions. They start thinking about how they want to change themselves. And I would say that's an ongoing process for me and for most people. But it's an intense time of year when people start thinking about their personal development. And this is the time when people often look at their goals and try to measure up if they achieved them or not. But the only way to do that is if you set them kind of specifically with a timeline. So I'd love to say I'm one of the, I've been thinking about setting intentions for 2019, but I don't really want to. And also I kind of think that whenever people are making New Year's resolutions, I understand it. Of course, we all have that urge to do it. But to me, it kind of devalues the your motivation to do it. Because, for example, when I, you know, quit drinking, I didn't wait till New Year's to do it. It wasn't because it was a new year. It was because it needed to happen. So to me, I feel like I should have, you know, what I strive for is the courage to be able to change the things that I need when I need them. So when I get to a new year, it shouldn't be, this is the new year, I need to change this. It should be, if I needed to change it, I already would have, or I'm already working on it, or I'm already thinking about it. And it's not because of what month it is, and it's not because of what day it is, but it's because of what I've realized about myself. So in that way, I'm really smart and better than most of you. That's an important thing for you to know. Man, it's been, it's, you know what? Here's what it is. It's the winter. We're in the dark time when it's like kind of, it's just dark all the time. And it's hard to have energy. It's hard to be up and about. It's hard to be out there. It's hard to leave your house when you have Knitting and 90 Day Fiance. And I have been watching a lot of 90 Day Fiance. And please let me know if you watch it, because damn, it is my favorite reality show. But of course, I've been visiting my family. And let me tell you the three emotions that that incurs. I would say comfort, but also exhaustion and frustration, as well as leisure. So that was more than three words, but you know, this is a part of, you know, and I don't think it has much to do with the time of year, but the place that I'm at with my family right now, there are, oh man, sometimes you have family members that are just fucking exhausting, you know, and it's like, with friends too, you know, you have to figure it out. So, I mean, if I had to think about what my goals are within the next year, my new thing is that I have to make friends, and I really don't want to do it, but it's like a thing I have to do. My best friend is moving out of the city, and I keep a pretty close circle around me. I don't really have a lot of people in my life because I don't care to. And, especially at this, the older I get, the more that I stay in my house and paint paintings. And I've talked about this before, but after I quit drinking, I think I kind of stopped going to social events outside of my, I kind of stopped going to social events unless I was coerced into it. And so that's probably bad, but I just would rather stay home and experiment with my gouache, which is opaque watercolors and not a sex thing. I have a lot of fun making art, and it's a lot of effort to make new friends. and I don't want to, but I don't know. Probably once I go to a job, I'll be back on a normal schedule. But so I have to make friends because I talk to my family a lot and I'm very close with them. I make this podcast. I do shows and I hang out with my best friend in Chicago, and she's moving soon. So now I have to make some friends so that I have anybody to hang out with in Chicago, and also to keep me in Chicago, because, like, what's the point? You know, I'm an adult, and like, why? Oh my God, why do I have to have friends? It's so exhausting. This sounds negative, but let's think about it in a positive way, because that's really been the thing that I wouldn't say focusing on, but just it's feeling natural. It's feeling very natural to think about things in a positive light as opposed to a negative way that creates anxiety. So I'll say, and this is true, I will say that I have learned to appreciate and value my time with myself and my time with my projects. And, you know, I think that's happened to me a lot in the past. And the thing about it is that there's sort of a dichotomy in my personality and, you know, everybody's. I'm not like a super special gal, except that, you know, it's just my boobs, obviously. But famous! Sometimes I draw a smiley face on them and do a puppet show. Beep, 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 beep. My mom listens to this. All right, moving on. That's not true, but I call them Punch and Judy. You know why? Because I always punch myself in the boob when I wake up. No, I don't. And that doesn't make any sense. But I will say, if you have any inventive alarm clocks, please give them to me, because the thing of the week is that, man, I overslept. We'll come back to that because I'm talking about something right now. But so what I'm talking about is valuing my time. As I've gotten older, as I've gone through relationships, as I've developed, you know, the type of art that I want to be making or the type of the way that that fits into my life. The way that I think of my time by myself has changed. And I think, you know, for many years, I was kind of afraid to be alone. And I, you know, have a lot of anxiety and I had horrible FOMO, fear of missing out. What a stupid word for what for such a real thing. And so I think with, but a lot of that comes from thinking that people, you know, don't like you and that you have to be somewhere for people to approve of you. So with increased self-confidence and increased clarity in terms of, you know, your interactions with other people, as you're able to kind of let go of those and enjoy yourself a little bit more and you're in the present, it also gives less urgency to the need to be around people so that I feel comfortable, you know, doing stuff at home. And as I get older, it brings me more kind of pleasure to have like, especially to have a nice home, to have like plants or to have my reading nook set up the way I want it to be. And it's been incredible to me to realize how much our, the atmosphere, our setting shapes our feelings and how beneficial it can be for me to shape those atmospheres so that they optimize my, not only my mood, but also my kind of internal world. Because when I, and let me just give a shout out right now to the, what is that Marie Kondo book? It's, I think that's her name. It's The Art of, all right, Aaron, this is a specific question for you. I see you Googling it already. And it's a very famous book by the name of, okay, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, which I did not read, but I did kind of do an overview on YouTube or something like that. Because I don't need to read a whole book about folding my clothes because that's a waste of time since I'm not going to fold them. Also, if somebody wants to do my laundry, please DM me on Instagram. I really need you to do this. I really need it because I hate it. I hate it. There's no laundry in my building and it's winter. So it's like, why would I want to? I would rather wear swimsuit bottoms as underwear than cart all of my laundry over to the laundromat in the salted sidewalks of Chicago. Like, what do I give a fuck? I'll keep buying sweatpants until the season ends. Don't try me, motherfucker. You know what I'm saying? Like it is. And you know what? If I go to Walmart and purchase my clothing, that's cheaper than washing it and I will donate it. So let's, how about that? And this is not my actual plan, but it's my actual resentment. I am so resentful. I don't want to do it. Ugh. I can wash the dishes. I hate that also, but it's reasonable. But the laundry, I just hate for some reason. It's just, you know what? Especially the biggest thing is leaving the house to do laundry. It's such a you know, first world problem. But I fucking hate it, and I refuse to do it. And shout out to everybody who knows me, who keeps telling me to do it. This is my format to say, hey, Kelly, I'm not fucking doing it. So eat my butt if you are into that and would consent. Man. So the more personal development I make, the more I think about the way that I spend my time by myself and the more that I value it, especially, you know, doing things that are really important to me, like reading or making art or having a beautiful home that makes me feel the light. You know, when you have a beautiful home, it makes you feel kind of glowy inside. It makes you feel like the light from the nice sunspot where your cat sits is also in your own heart. And so you feel like you have, because there's not much we can control in this chaotic universe. And so if I have, you know, the picture frame hung straight, I feel like, you know what? This is mine. I feel a sense of ownership. I feel a sense of love in my home that it's set up for me in a way that, it feels like your house loves you. That's such a weird way to explain it. But, you know, I think as I'm getting older, I'm 28 now, and there are things that matter to me now that didn't used to matter to me. So things like, you know, having long-term partners or having a beautiful house or, you know, having stability and health insurance, of course, which, isn't so much, I mean, it's an age thing and it's not. I think it's just an overall consideration for humans, but it just so happens that as you get older, you have to deal with it yourself. But so the way that I spend time by myself is something that I value a lot now. And I do have a hard time keeping that kind of sacred, but especially when I'm painting, it's this kind of meditative state that I'm able to, it kind of makes my worries melt away, you know? And like, it gives me cramps in my back and I have carpal tunnel from only doing calligraphy and knitting all the time. So I don't know if somebody could pay me for that. That would be great. But, you know, so I'm all achy and like cramped up and like I've, you know, maybe I ate bad food and I've only binge watched a TV show and been drinking cold brew in my craft room for 2 days. But it feels really awesome to retreat into a world of focus. It's a flow state. It's not, you know, and when you're doing it in a healthy way, it's not escapism. Although I would say sometimes when you have really traumatic stuff happen in your life, when people die, when you have a big move, when you, you know, all the typical life stressors that bring a lot of anxiety and sadness to people, it's normal to have that kind of escape. I think that's soothing. That's normal. It's stabilizing. But I think in addition to that, having a routine where I do that, you know, and I'm not escaping, I'm rather kind of engaging in the solace of, I wouldn't call it productivity, but it's that flow state of being connected, you know, especially with visual art. You know, when I'm making it, it's being connected with your body in some sense. It's having control over, and it's having control over the way that your body is making something. However, I would say that there are two sides to that coin in that I don't have a whole lot of control over it. The way that I have control over it is how often I do it determines how well I can do it. I don't feel like I have control over how well the thing I make turns out, how realistic it is, but I have control over how much I practice, and the more I practice, the more it gets better, and then I can see that. And I think that's kind of unique, because when I'm doing comedy or something like that, I feel like I have control over that. Like, I can write these jokes, I know how to write a punchline, I can say like, hey, I need to punch this up, I need to cut this, I need to pull that back, I have to add a tag to this, and then I have to, I'm going to segue into this because these two are going to link, so they can be, you know, these bits can be a chunk, and then we're going to do that. You know, to lead into my next joke. So I feel like I have a technical control over that. And while there's still obviously an ineffable quality to creating and to writing, I feel that is something that is, I always thought I was going to be a writer from the time I was young. And that's something that I guess I feel that I have a sense of mastery of it, that I have enough confidence in, that I do feel like, although, you know, of course, the finished product is always going to be, you know, different than you expect, in the sense that, like, you know, things will change and you'll make decisions as you're going along, right? And different factors will influence you, and maybe the venue, maybe the people that you're around, maybe the people that you're editing with, maybe the life events that are happening to you. But ultimately, I feel confident enough in my mastery of writing that I feel like I have control over the finished product. And so much of it is about editing, in the sense that I have a lot of templates in my head for how an essay should look, how a concise joke should look, how a story should look. And those things, while not universal and well made to be challenged, are also inform the way that I feel that I have this idea in my head of how to, when I see a sentence, and obviously it's better when I look at other people and not my own work, because it can be kind of difficult. Sometimes you need to take a step back. But when I hear a sentence, I can figure out a way to better convey it to an audience. I can figure out who maybe couldn't access it. And that's not to say I'm an expert and I'm going to get it, but I can say, you know, I think it'll make people feel more if we do it this way. So with writing and jokes, I feel like I have a mastery of it, in the sense that I create it, I control it, I perform it, I implement it, I edit it. And I feel like I could say to myself, I'm going to write an album, so this is how I'm going to go. I have an idea of the finished product. So then I figure out the steps that it takes to get to that finished product, but I know what the finished product is going to be. With visual art, it's not like that for me, because for me, it's all discovery. And so when I sit down to make something, All I have is my effort and the amount of work I'm willing to put into it. And a lot of the times I get new mediums and I just am like, I just start experimenting with them until it looks like something. And I've got a ton of, I should share it, but I've got a ton of horrible art that comes out of it. And I wouldn't call it horrible. It's a learning experience, but it's not stuff that I'm, you know, want to hang on my walls. It's stuff where I'm like, the way that this turned out, I don't like, you know, it was just on the path to making something else. It's a sketch that I would easily throw away. Or whatever, or something I wasn't passionate about enough about to like put more effort into refining it. And it's really strange because like I did take some art classes when I was young, but it wasn't, and I've always liked to make art, but not, I didn't think of it as like a professional thing or as like really a skill that I could control. And to me, the excitement of it is in the exploration and the discovery of trying new of the challenge of seeing different mediums and saying, hey, I could do that. Like, how would it look if I did this? And then the result is always a surprise, especially when I started printmaking, you know, which kind of I just saw linoleum block printmaking on Instagram. And I was like, I remember I did that once in middle school and I was like, I could do that. You just go to the art store and you get the stuff and then you try it a bunch until it looks good. And so especially with that kind of thing, with painting, with block printing, I don't know what it's going to look at like at the end, and it surprises me. But I do know that the control that I have over it is that the more hours I put into it, the more the better it looks. But I never have an idea of what it's going to look like. I don't have control over that. But it does. But it is satisfying, and it's exciting, and it's you know, it's fun. I think also now I've been making art for long enough that it seems like a thing because to me, you know, comedy is my career, but art is like a hobby. And while I do think a lot of the things that I make, like holiday cards and things like that, they're definitely, you know, sellable. They're little handmade crafts or like I make a bunch of scarves and I give them away because I need somebody to use them because I don't need 10 scarves, but I like making them. And it's satisfying and rewarding. And I love having a product when I'm done and being able to look at it and say, like, not only I did it, but to look at it and like really revel in its creation and to say, because it surprises me. I'm like, that's amazing. It's stunning to me to look at it. And especially some of the things that turn out really well, I'm like, I do not know how I did that. Like, I don't know how I did that. It just feels lucky. It feels like something else made it. But what I've realized is the more I practice, the more I have those results. So I guess it's me. It just doesn't feel like it, you know, because it's such a discovery experience. But I've been thinking a lot about that, partly probably because the thing that I always feel, especially when I started kind of making art again at this point in my adulthood is, you know, I have been doing comedy for 5 years and, when I renewed my interest in art as an adult, because it's always been a big part of my life, like making crafts, drawing, doodling is a big part of like how I learn. It's like I'm a very kinesthetic learner and I have to be kind of drawing things in order to keep listening during a 30-minute lecture or something like that. I can't look at the person. I have to be moving my hand. So like a lot of the time for me, taking notes was not so much about being able to look back at the notes, but only because it would help me digest what they were saying. And if I didn't do it, I wouldn't remember. But it was about the kinesthetic element, the tactile element. So when I kind of had a renewed interest and effort into kind of my artistic output as an adult, it was because my best friend here in Chicago, it was during my mental breakdown. She's crazy. Watch her cry at the bar. Everybody steer clear or talk about pizza. Anyway, it was a difficult time in my life and I was floundering. And she said to me, you always really liked to draw when we were in college. And why don't you do that anymore? And it hadn't even occurred to me. And looking back on it, I did have a bunch of markers and I would do a lot of drawing by myself. And I would organize like craft nights for us to all do arts and crafts. And I would do a lot of crafts. When I was an RA, I would use that as a reason to make a bunch of Valentines or make a bunch of crafts. So like I always integrate it. That's always been the way that I show people that I care about them. And that's insane to realize because I didn't know it was happening. It's always been the way, you know, when I get really inspired and want to show people that I care about them, it's always like I make you a card or I draw you something or I make you a scarf. And That can be really time consuming. And once you start it, you get in over your head and then it would consume me and I would make it a priority above other things. And it's just an extra project that I tacked on. But to me, it's more important than the other shit that I'm doing, which is bad for your job. But I guess that kind of ties into the, you know, the reason that I feel, I guess, called or, you know, focused on making that stuff. Because to me, it does feel more important and it feels more rewarding to kind of reach out to people in that way. So when I started, my best friend came to me when I was kind of floundering and she was like, you used to do all this stuff in college. I think you really enjoyed it. I think that would help you. You should do it now. And I said, okay. And I started drawing with markers and, you know, just doing kind of portraits with markers. So it was just like fun drawings and, you know, they looked like humans. And I guess if you do it with markers, it's kind of like, what is that, a cartoon? I don't know. But, you know, kind of, it was almost like I was doing a painting with markers. So I started doing that and then I started doing printmaking and then it just kind of went on from there because everything you do, there's another step. It's like, okay, now I'm going to put prints on fabric. Okay, now I can make whatever I want. I can make a tablecloth. I can make a t-shirt. Now I'm going to, make a watercolor. And now, I've done watercolor, but I like to do calligraphy and something that's going to integrate really well with that is gouache. And that's a more, you know, I see a lot of people using that medium when they're using ink. So now I want to try that. And, you know, I just keep trying stuff. I will say I can't do oil paints. Like, you know, I can try, but it's just so frustrating. It's really difficult for, I think it's a longer half-life on the drying for that medium. And it's just, oh man, it's challenging for me. So I'll tackle that more in the future sometime. But So that's when I started doing it. And that was, I really got very, very deep into it because it was the only time that I didn't feel horrible suffering because I was really depressed and having a lot of panic attacks and had had some bad stuff happen to me in my life at that point. It was the only thing that got me into a flow state and made me forget about things for a little bit. And all of my emotions were coming out that way. And it was helping me a bunch, you know, it was the only thing because I was really spinning my wheels I was drinking a lot and like talking to people, you know, when you kind of, you're doing too much, but nothing you do helps. You can recognize those people when they're having a hard time in their lives and they can't feel good and they keep chasing it. And it's like you drink, you go out drinking with them and they get hammered and then they keep going and going and going and going. And it's not, you know, and then they always, you know, and they're like that with everything. Like they'll talk to you, but then they get too intense and they keep going and going and going and going and they want your approval or whatever. You can tell when somebody's going through a hard time and they're trying to find solutions and none of the solutions are working. And so that, I think art kind of saved me in a lot of ways. And granted, I was going into therapy at this time and it all coincided, but it gave me this understanding of myself that helped me to learn how to be a person and how to learn that I had grown. And a lot of the time when I make things, I do a lot of portraits and, you know, other people will do different subjects. They'll, you know, draw houses or draw, landscapes or leaves or something. And I noticed about myself that I draw a lot of faces and I try to get a bunch of people to say, hey, I'm, you know, okay with you drawing me so I can practice. And what I've realized is that when I'm doing a big project, I feel like I am spending time with that person, learning about them and caring about them. So like when I sit down to make a block print carving of my sister, it's because I'm trying to understand something about her. Or, that comes as a byproduct. And I feel like I've spent time thinking about that person's life and kind of trying to walk in their shoes, even though, you know, it's unconscious. So I would say in that way, you know, art kind of saved me. And that's really weird to realize now because I'm trying to find how it fits in my life, especially as a performer. But I would say that I perform comedy and that can drain me of some social resources. And then when I make art, it's very personal and that kind of replenishes me. The problem with that is, wow, the only things I'm good at, nobody will pay me to do. So, I don't know. Join my Patreon, please. I've got some cool stuff coming out. I'm going to make some buttons and stickers and things. And you can check out, if you want to see some of my art, I've got an Instagram for it. It's Lainey Made It. So feel free to check that out. But really, it's a passion project for me. So those are my thoughts on art. And as you know, I think in this time, you know, at this point in history, at this point in, you know, my life, and a lot of the people who listen to me are around my age, or, you know, at any point in life, that's the best way that you can conquer sadness and destruction is by creating something. That's, to me, one of the kind of, you know, when I think about people's religion, that's kind of how I process it. I understand it in that kind of idea of like positive light, creative energy. That's important to me. And that is meaningful in a way that I think is kind of spiritual. And that the older I get, the more I sound like such a hippie. But, you know, it's good to be invested in the things that you love. And that kind of creative spirit comes with any work that you do. If it's, you know, scientific, if it's, you know, social work, building things is harder than tearing them down. And building things, people who build things are not only attractive, but they're compelling, they're inspiring. And so, and that's, I lose that feeling every day, especially being somebody with depression. And it's much easier to feel bad about myself and hate myself and think that I can't do it. And I do constantly. And at this point in my life, I'm trying to find ways to make my communities people who believe in me. Because when people believe in you, it challenges you to actually do the stuff that you've been having excuses for. Because if you're surrounded by people who are kind of negative, it makes you feel like you can't do it, but it also kind of makes you self-sabotage. But if you're surrounded by people who say, I know you can do it, like, I love what you make, you know, the sky's the limit. So I'm trying to learn how to make stuff. And I've said that before, but if you're making something, send it to me, please. I would love to see it. And whatever you're making, if you're writing a paper, that counts too, you know? So I guess I'm glad that that came out of the rant today. I never know what I'm going to talk about, but that's something that now I'm feeling kind of emotional, but that brings me joy. And it's like the only kind of true north that I've been able to find in my life, you know, my family, and then that kind of artistic and creative spirit. So I would really love to see what other people are making. And I hope, and in the more I hear people caring about the things I make, it's jaw-dropping for me. Because I do get recognized in public sometimes and things like that, but I don't think of it, you know, it's hard to digest as a human being. And when I meet somebody who really appreciates what I do in a way that's changed them, that floors me. And that floors me. So I love making stuff, and please join my Patreon, because I don't want to have my job for that long. Oh my God. Oh, but if you join my Patreon, I'm making a bunch of cool pins and stickers and stuff that I really want to share with you, because I'm super excited and I'm designing them myself. So check that out. Weird plug, but you know what? Make shit. Just fucking make it. Okay, well, I've talked a lot about how isolated I am and how isolated I make myself, but our sponsor this week can help me with that. So I'm going to really look into using them. I haven't gotten a sample yet, but I'm really excited to try it. So this week, It's Lainey is brought to you by BuddyBox, a monthly subscription service. BuddyBox is perfect for the weeks when your boss is driving you nuts, you missed the bus and stepped in a puddle, and your outfit is full of wrinkles and you forget your keys at home. So it's for anybody who has a rotten week and needs to kick back with a glass of wine, a bubble bath, and get some precious me time, you know? And sure, self-care is important, but in this internet age of pings, likes, and retweets, it's also important to make time to connect with actual human beings, which I hate. That's where BuddyBox comes in. A monthly subscription service, BuddyBox sends you a fully customized companion for those weeks when you just can't get out of the house every week. Now, you may think it sounds a little strange, but who doesn't need to vent about a stressful week or knock back a couple brews while talking shit about your boss? You know, that's just healthy. With BuddyBox, you can be sure that not only do you have the perfect pal to relax with, but you're also assured complete privacy and discretion. While human friends offer comfort and support in our times of need, they can also be a pesky liability. And I would include myself, because, man, sometimes it's hard to keep your big-ass trap shut. With BuddyBox, you can choose from a number of preset options for your homunculus, including gender, race, volume, and knowledge, personality presets based on fields of expertise, political attitudes, and more. Having human contact and companionship is important to our physical and emotional well-being, as we all know. But where we get that comfort and revitalization, well, that's totally up to us. Making new friends is time-consuming, emotionally exhausting, and frankly, sometimes more work than it's worth. BuddyBox is perfect for recent transplants, young professionals with tight schedules, and exceptional personalities. So if you have trouble finding somebody who can keep up with you when you're discussing fine wines, cartography, old Ginger Rogers musicals, the intricacies of the Babysitter's Club, BuddyBox is quick, easy, and sends you the perfect friend. To sign up for a 90-day free trial, visit BuddyBox.com to browse personality options, or if you want to try one of their 300 personality presets, browse the build it yourself option. For a limited time, BuddyBox is offering its Lainey listeners double the trial time when you choose the Lainey model. If you want to spend morning, noon, and night with me, visit www.buddybox.com and enter the offer code It's Lainey, ITSLAINIE. BuddyBox, they're definitely not sex dolls. That's also what I call my vagina. BuddyBox.com. Get in my BuddyBox. It's time to party. That's the slogan I'll use for them. All right. Well, it has come time for the motherfucking question. And this week it is a humdinger. So let's get right into it. The question this week is, do you think you should hit your kids, specifically boys? Should boys develop a healthy fear of women at a young age? Yay or nay? So for this question, let's imagine that I have a child that's a boy, which is, oh my God, first of all, congratulations to me. Did I do a gender reveal party? Absolutely not. That's horrible. What did I name him? I don't know. Thomas, some bullshit. I didn't name him that, but who knows? I don't have a name, so we'll call him baby boy. Do you think you should hit your kids, specifically boys? I would not hit my kids. I wasn't hit. I wouldn't do it. It doesn't really make sense to me. I also see it very much from a psychological point of view because it has a lot to do with the type of attachment that you make to your parents. So there are a few different kinds of attachment, like secure, dismissive, fearful, anxious. But the way that, you know, corporal punishment connects you to your parent does not really directly change behavior. It changes relationship as opposed to getting a child to understand or, you know, get a kind of sense of right or wrong. So I think that I wouldn't do it. One of the reasons is because I don't think it works because it doesn't give a child, you know, it's like, how do I say it? It's not connected with the thing that you're trying to teach them. They don't learn if you smack them. They just get hurt. You know, they don't learn. They just get punished. They're just like, oh, bad. But they don't learn which part of it is bad, which part of it is good. What is the edited behavior, you know? And so this has a lot to do, for me, I mean, with, you know, the way that we're conditioned as children. So like our operant conditioning, our classical conditioning, right? So like, because that kind of negative, it's not negative reinforcement because negative reinforcement is a different thing. That kind of punishment is so, how would I say? I guess it's just such an intense stimulus that it conditions children in a way that doesn't really make sense. So it just says bad, negative feelings. But, you know, if I want you to be good at, if I want you to behave well at Thanksgiving dinner, and every time you don't behave well at Thanksgiving dinner, I slap you, you know, what does that tell the kid? It maybe tells the kid every time Aunt Myrna comes, I get slapped, you know? So you don't know what kind of association you're making. So it doesn't necessarily tell them, hey, because, and this is the reason why, because that is an instant feeling. So if you try to connect that with something else previous that's not instant, that's not an association the child is going to make. They're going to remember, you know, what the situation is or what room they're in or something like that. It's going to be connected to that, and it's going to make that room the bad room or that parent the bad parent, but it's not going to mean that you won't slurp your ice cream 2 hours ago. So it doesn't work, essentially. And it also is going to, you know, alter the type of connection you have with your parent. Because like I said, there are a few different types of reinforcement. So there's positive reinforcement, obviously, you know, oh my God, you did a great job. I'll give you a hug. Oh my God, you did a great job. Here's a piece of candy. Negative reinforcement, contrary to what most people think, is when you remove something negative as a reward. So for example, like if your mom keeps nagging you to clean your room and then, you know, the only thing that'll get her to stop is if you clean your room. Or, for example, if you have a really annoying sibling and they won't stop whistling because they want you to do something, right? Oh my God, my sisters do this. I fucking hate it. Whistling is not a thing for adults. Don't do it. I hate it. Stop. And also, when I ask you to stop politely, fucking stop. It's not like a cute, fun thing. It's a murder creator. Okay. I hate it. But negative reinforcement is not the same as punishment. Negative reinforcement is if my sister said, hey, can I have, or will you go get me a sandwich? And I said, no. And she says, okay, well, I'm going to whistle until you do it. And she keeps whistling and whistling and whistling and driving me crazy. And finally I say, fine, I'll get you a sandwich. And I bring it to her. And then she stops whistling. That's what negative reinforcement is. And this is in, you know, like, what do you call it? You know, child development theory or child development psychology. And then punishment, of course, is punishment. So it's like, oh, you did this wrong, slap. You did this wrong, time out. You did this wrong. You know, it's punishment. And then that, you know, one of the things that's going to govern your relationship with your parent or your relationship with your caretaker and characterize it is going to be the type of attachment you have. And of course, there are all kinds of, the most famous study on this is with the rhesus monkeys, right? So that's the study, God, who is this, Maslow? I don't know. This is the study. So they had these rhesus monkeys. And they had one set of monkeys that... So they had, they took them away from their mothers. And then they had a monkey that was covered in, you know, a fake monkey, like made out of wire that was covered in like carpet and soft things for the, you know, the monkey to cuddle with. And then they had one that was made out of wire and it had, it fed it, you know, it had like the feeding, you know, like, I don't know what you call the feeding thing that gerbils get or whatever. So that's where it could get its nutrients. But that one was not covered in the comfortable material. It was just made out of wire. And they found that even... when the monkeys had both options, they would go eat from the, you know, mother that provided and then go back to the, you know, the one that snuggled them. And even when they could only choose one, they would still choose to snuggle with the, you know, snuggly one, even though the other one was providing them nutrients. And that has a lot to do with the type of connection, you know, obviously, it's like also the baby Albert experiment. If you don't know that, look it up. It's super fucked up. Would not be allowed now. But, you know, that research is inappropriate, but the thing they were trying to uncover is the way that we develop the type of attachment that we have with our parents and how it affects us to not have that attachment from birth at a young age when it develops. So, and I'm not an expert on this and I don't remember everything about it, but there are different types of connection. And there's so many experiments about this that I've read that are really fascinating, but you know, I'll move on. So there are a few different kinds of attachment. So there's secure attachment, which of course means that, you know, as an infant, you're bonded with the parent, you know, in a healthy way. It looks like a, you know, what you would hope a normal, healthy relationship to be. There is... anxious slash preoccupied attachment. And let me know if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure. So that one, they did these experiments where they had children, they put children in a room playing with a toy and they had the parents leave and say, hey, I'm going to go do this. I'll be right back. And then they were seeing, based on the relationship to the parent, like what kind of reaction the kid had. So kids with a secure attachment to their parent, they're comfortable because they know that their parent comes and picks them up from daycare. They're always, you know, they have a normal relationship and they know, oh, she's leaving, but she's coming back. Or they, you know, cry for a while, but then they get over it. You know, they know that even if they can't see the parent is going to be there. So that's a secure attachment. For a child with, for example, a dismissive an avoidant relationship. That's a child who has an attachment with a parent that they aren't essentially their parent hasn't been dependable physically in a way that has bonded them to the child. So they don't know if they're coming back. So of course they had a lot of different types of people in the study. And, you know, it could be parents who maybe were drug addicts and didn't take care of their kids and like didn't come back a lot or things like that. But that kind of attachment, dismissive or avoidant attachment, is when the, you know, parent leaves. And then when they come back, the kid kind of ignores them and is like kind of weird around, nervous around them. And usually that stems from, you know, having an insecure attachment in that they don't know, you know, maybe they weren't nursed when they were supposed to be nursed, or they weren't touched a lot in the cradle, or they didn't have the human contact they were supposed to have, like physically. And those kind of things nurture an insecure attachment, meaning that the child on a physical level doesn't feel that assuredness that the parent, you know, they have an instinctual fear response because they don't have this, this sensation instilled in themselves that they have a parent that's taking care of them, you know? So when they disappear, they disappear and they don't know when they're coming back. And so when they come back, they're really cautious because they're like, you know, you never know when they're coming or going. And this is all pretty basic. And then fearful avoidant, I think, has to do with if that parent is like punishing them in ways that are damaging and that kind of thing. But those types of attachments happen so early in life and govern our relationships for a lifetime. And of course, it's not the only thing that factors in, but it's an important part. It's like one of the biggest, you know, tenets of childhood development psychology. So that being said, the use of corporal punishment is not it doesn't seem to be supportive of, you know, that kind of secure attachment. And that kind of behavior, or that kind of relationship, has later implications in life. You know, of course, they do all these studies and then they find that kids with insecure attachments are more likely to use drugs, or they're more likely to be less high achieving or make less money or whatever it is. And so to me, it is, number one, not useful because it doesn't connect in the child's head the message that you're trying to send. And number two, harmful because it detracts from a secure relationship, which having a secure type of relationship, a bonded relationship with a parent, is something that will govern a child's behavior into adulthood and, their sense of self. So that's kind of a technical look at the psychology end of things based on my general childhood psychology courses. But so, you know, that being said, I wouldn't hit my kids. And the biggest reason, I think, is because I wasn't hit. So it wouldn't even occur to me. I remember when I was being little, being spanked a little bit, but it was kind of like a for show thing. You know, it wasn't like painful. It was just like, you're getting a spanking. And then it's like, you know, I'm telling you that I'm displeased with you. And like, so I don't know how that would have changed my life if that was a role later. I don't know if it would have changed. I'm not sure, but that was, a lot of the times, I don't know, that was a male disciplinarian, right? And I don't remember it very much. So who knows how that would have affected my life, or if it would have changed, or if it would have affected it. Like I said, I wouldn't hit my kids, specifically boys. Should boys develop a healthy fear of women at a young age, yay or nay? The answer is no, because fear-conditioned responses don't accomplish anything. They do not result in behaviors that either make sense or achieve what you're trying to achieve. So, like, fear-conditioned behaviors are going to make the child feel chaos, which then makes them unpredictable or makes them, feel weak or feel less secure. And so, not only are they not going to do what you want because they're afraid of you, but they're also going to, so number one, it's not going to work. And then number two, it's going to make them, I think, more of a wild card, like more likely to act out because they have this kind of, this like fear of a parent. So it doesn't work. And in fact, it would make your life more difficult in the long run. So it doesn't even make sense. I would say that thinking about characterizing relationships of Should boys develop a healthy fear of women at a young age? I would say no. And again, because children who develop fear are less likely to be able to succeed in life, to be able to do what you ask them to do, to be able to be willing to do what you ask them to do. It's not going to work, and it's going to fuck them up. It's going to fuck them up real bad. What I will say about the development of a relationship with women at a young age for boys, and I've talked about this before, and it's been fascinating and an ongoing conversation, is the way that boys develop a connection to women at a young age. And of course, a mother is the first relationship being, this kind of bonding, infancy, life-giving relationship. But separate from that, once kids start getting socialized, the way that we socialize boys is really fascinating to me, especially now because I, at this age, am able to kind of look at it and ask people questions, but I never noticed it before because it wasn't in front of me. I don't have any brothers. I don't, and the thing that was really fascinating for me was we talked about the kind of sex ed, like if boys were informed about how to respect women in terms of like consent. And generally, they're not really educated about that, I think kind of as a general thing. But I think so much, I think a ton now about the way that young boys are taught to, be connected to women, because so much of it is, number one, modeled upon their male role models. So like, if dad doesn't think what mom has to say is important, you kind of grow up thinking like, what women say isn't important, and that's the same for like, if you see him hit her, if you see him cheat on her, if you see him, you're going to become your dad. And it is really interesting and really different when I have male friends who are raised by women, and we do have certain things upon which we can agree or we can relate to each other differently. And it's a different type of communication. So I think a ton about, when these issues are coming up about like Me Too movement stuff or like feminism, and a lot of times people will be like, well, what do you want us to do? Like, you say the system's broken and blah, blah, blah. And, a lot of the time what I think is like, we should be teaching our kids that women are important, that they are powerful, that they're strong, that it's okay for a woman to be your role model. Because that's another thing. It's like, yeah, exactly. Because it's like, if you ask any guy, any kid, like who his role model is, it's never a woman, it's almost never a woman. And it's, and I have that experience in comedy a lot. It's like, who are your favorite female comics? And people are like, I don't know. And I do have a few friends, and most of them were raised by women who are like, I love, these female comics, and they really inspired me to do this. And that's amazing. But, generally across the board, the way that boys are taught is that they are supposed to figure out how to kind of fight over everybody, make their voices heard. They're, it's important for them to express their individuality and take control of situations. And then our girls are taught that they should be kind of blending in. Like, you shouldn't be too loud. You shouldn't be offensive. You're supposed to be ladylike. Like, you're supposed to cross your legs, because God forbid somebody should see, your secret garden. But boys know. So I think about this a ton because, I don't have boys, but I think about what would happen if I did have kids and if they were boys, and I would have a lot of really important things that I would want to instill in them. And that's, one of those things would be, because there is this gender difference in toys, like colors, like, oh, pink is a girl's color. And I know it's kind of a hippy dippy thing to say like that doesn't matter, but to me that is important because, when things associated with femininity are associated with negativity, badness, and weakness, the message to boys is women are weak, women are bad, women are like, you don't want to be like a woman. And that doesn't make any sense, because a lot of the people that I know, their strongest friends, allies, their strongest champions are women. And so I think that, no, I don't think boys should develop a healthy fear of women at a young age. They should develop a healthy admiration. because a lot of the times, the boys that I know that were raised by women, they have this reverence for their moms that is, and for their grandmas and for the strong women in their lives that they know, where they really celebrate the women around them when they have successes and when they see what they can do and when they see what they can do that's maybe a little bit different than what, you know, the boys themselves do. It gives you an appreciation for parts of life that you, you know, maybe would have been trained out of you otherwise. And so being able to acknowledge the strength and the kind of, you know, being able to take inspiration from women is something that's conditioned out of our boys and something that really makes them better people. Like the people I know who have that, it's beautiful. The way they talk about it, it's really meaningful to them. They have better relationships. They're better able to communicate with people. And this, of course, is based on like healthy relationships, you know, because if you have unhealthy relationships with your parents, regardless, that's going to fuck you up. And we all, you know, are fucked up in whatever way. But I don't think we need them to fear us. We need them to idolize us. They have to be able to see ladies and go, wow, that's amazing. And I'll be the first one. Excellent. Well, this has been the motherfucking question. No, I will not hit my kids. And if they are boys, they will respect my blazer, goddammit. But they will celebrate the success of the women around them as well as the men, you know, but it's important that they can see those strengths and those victories and those, you know, kind of champions. That was a good question. Thank you very much. This has been, wow, what a week. What a week. I've been really emotional this week. So that's kind of an intense question to get, but, oh my goodness. Thank you for the question. Keep them coming. You can send them to Lainey@LaineyLeonards.com. Thank you to our sponsor this week, Buddy Box. Make sure to check them out. You can see me Tuesday, December 11th at Chuck at the Beat Kitchen. That's Chicago Underground Comedy, one of my favorite shows of all time. DM me if you want to get tickets because I got you. Also, Saturday, December 15th, hosting the Comedy Cabaret at 11 p.m. at the Comedy Bar. More to come. I'm producing a show on the 11th of January. So mark your calendars down for that. I have more stuff coming and it's going to be a really weird indie show. So it's going to be fun. You can check me out on the Multiple Idiots podcast, also here on the Jazz Plus Network, Cutting It Up with my good friend Mike O'Keefe. I'm auditioning to be his groomsman. So feel free to check that out. It's episode 9. And then coming up, you can also check me out on B. Casper's podcast, also on the Jazz Plus Network. That time I got arrested. I'm going to have an upcoming interview out on that. So check me out there too. They're really great podcasts. So I think you'll love them. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Lainey Leonards. Leonards is L-E-N-E-R-T-Z, like zebra cake. And if you want to check out my art again, you can see my new Instagram. It's at Lainey Made It. So, you know, I made a bunch of stuff, so check it out. So those are the shows I have coming up. Always feel free to message me on Instagram, send me a new motherfucking question. And please, if you have any compassion in your heart, follow me on Patreon. If you think this is worth anything, please, even $2 a month, I would love to, you know, be able to send you guys a bunch of, I have so much cool stuff I'm working on, like pins, stickers, and like art and, you know, different, I've got a lot of videos coming out and things like that. So check it out there. I'm going to be updating that soon. So feel free to take a look. But wow, this has been such an episode, Kelly. I'm glad you were here. I think you should change your name because it's a really boring name. I have been watching a ton of 90 Day Fiancé, so let me just say Danielle needs to get her shit together. But, you know, I've had fun spending this time with you. This has been really important to me, and you're part of my heart, and you're also part of my stomach. So please send macaroni and cheese. So, you know what? I'm going to end with a catchphrase. Here we go. 1, 2, 3. They're definitely not sex dolls. It's Lainey. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Get it.